Museum of the Moving Image welcomes you to the Pinewood Dialogues Online, an archive of conversations with innovative creative figures in film, television, and digital media. Visit Museum of the Moving Image in New York City or online at www.movingimage.us.
Please welcome Bennett Miller. Could you just tell us a bit about how you got from doing The Cruise to this?
The Cruise was a documentary, mm-hmm. which I guess was done about 7 years ago now. Mm-hmm. After that, I was looking for a long time for the right thing to do, and I began directing television commercials, which allowed me to wait because I didn't have to do anything for money. And maybe 3 or 4 years went by doing that before a childhood friend of mine named Dan Futterman, who I'd known since I was 12, sent me his script for this movie. And we said, okay, let's give it a go.
And had he done a lot of other scripts before?
This was Danny's first screenplay. Mm-hmm. And this is my first narrative feature. And this is Phil Hoffman's first foray into producing.
Now, you had both known, is it true that you'd both known Philip for a while?
Yeah, Danny and I knew each other since we were 12. And, and Danny and I knew Phil since we were 16.
From what? In what context?
We did a theater program after our junior year in high school. Phil lived upstate New York. Danny and I grew up in Westchester. And it was the New York State Summer School of the Arts that was held in Saratoga. And it was like an acting program.
Okay. Now, I noticed the film, there's a credit for United Artists. So I'm just wondering, were they in the first company to back this film?
United Artists made this film.
Yeah.
It took us about a year. Phil and I flew around trying to raise the money for it. And eventually, the folks at United Artists, who originally said no, said yes. Mm-hmm. And what had happened is that Sony Corporation purchased United Artists. Mm-hmm. And I think the guys at United Artists said, you know, what do we have to lose? It's, you know, Phil and I had come in there with a lot of passion.
Yeah.
And they all knew that they were not going to have their jobs in about 6-8 months. And it was sort of like a Hail Mary pass. Like, like we'll just, you know, if it turns out okay, they were geniuses. If not, like, they're gone.
This was Bingham Ray running UA?
Bingham was already gone. It was Danny Rosette,
okay.
who I am eternally grateful for saying yes after everybody said no.
Okay. And tell us a bit about your approach to this material. I mean, what's fascinating about what you're working with is that you've got the real-life murder, you have the movie in Cold Blood, the book in Cold Blood, the biography, Gerald Clark's biography of Truman Capote. So there's a lot of different layers going on. I'm just wondering how you sort of threw all that.
It's a lot.
Yeah.
But for me, the reasons for doing the film were simple. I read the script, and I kind of sat with it for a little bit, and there was a feeling that it created, and there was, for me, a reason for doing it, and the reason for doing it was specific. It's not a traditional biopic, and it does not burden itself with the responsibility of covering, you know, all the bases of a person's life.
Right.
For me, the great resources that were available for us, you know, in Cold Blood, the you know, Truman's story, Gerald Clark's incredible biography that I would recommend to everybody, were really just a resource to serve a smaller purpose. It's just it's a very classical tragedy.
Right.
It's a classical tragedy, and it so happens to be based in reality.
The tragedy being that it's inevitable. And what's what's interesting about the story, of course, is that it's both about Truman Capote's rise to fame, but built into that is his destruction.
That's right.
Yeah.
It's inevitable. It's somebody whose downfall is the consequence of his own character.
Yeah.
So he had everything, and really, you know, answered prayers. He got everything he wanted, and yet in so doing, sowed the seeds to his own demise.
But the fact that you are not doing the standard biopic, in a way, puts more of a burden on you, because the film is really about the nuances of what's happening to him. For the film to work, you have to understand very finite, very small things.
There's two things going on here. One is there's the story and the plot of a person going about doing what he needs to do to write his masterpiece. But what's happening beneath the surface is a very private tragedy. And what's really going on right from the very beginning, the event is sort of a calling to Truman, and nobody knows what's going on with him. It's never made explicit. So you have a very public person with, you know, an explicit action and plot. So public person with that charisma and the sort of very private and more disturbing reality that's happening beneath. And
but so, this all has to be suggested. I mean, so there's a love that he feels for, that grows towards Perry. It's under the surface. It's on,
right. Yeah. Right. He does not share with anybody what is really going on.
Yeah.
You know, it's a totally private internal experience.
Could you talk a bit about then working with Philip Seymour Hoffman? It's such an uncanny performance that it's like breathtaking in a way to see him.
Actually, I did an interview with Phil yesterday talking about his process, which I don't think he likes to talk about that much himself. I still find it interesting how he works. But we've known each other for a long time.
Yeah.
He's a deep thinker. He really knows how to, you know, dig deeper and peel back the layers and, you know, going through the script together and really discussing, like, you know, what's going on and, like, this is what's on the surface and what's the next level and what's the next level. He really works hard. You know, I don't think anybody works harder to prepare and all the physical aspect of it, you know, the voice and the physicality. But those are not the things that make him a great actor. It's not his intelligence and it's not his preparation and his work. It's all of that stuff, I think, prepares him to a level, and he ingests that. He's got that preparation, but when he is in the moment and the truth of the moment presents itself, he really relinquishes everything and all ideas and, you know, preconceptions. For us, it was really a process of getting to the place where we felt comfortable enough that it could be discovered when the cameras were rolling. In rehearsals, preparation began about 6 months out for him. Rehearsals, you know, began maybe 2.5 months out. And 2 weeks before, it was just full-on working it. But we never rehearsed anything to the point where it actually happened, you know. And the first time it was going to happen, the cameras would be rolling. And we really left room for that sort of, the kind of magic that happens.
Yeah. Could you talk specifically about the party scenes? I love those scenes because they have such a great flavor to them. They capture him being both boisterous at the same time as you can also sense his loneliness.
Yeah, it's hard to contrive something like that.
Yeah,
and we did not try to. We really left it to creating, you know, the atmosphere and the circumstances for it to happen, and he pretty much improvises every word in those scenes.
Mm-hmm. What was it that you had in mind that sort of gave you the confidence or sense of what the whole film was going to be like? I mean, were you thinking of other films?
Other films? I like quiet films where things are going on in the ether, you know, in films that somehow feel conscious.
Mm-hmm.
That I didn't want to tell the story so much as I wanted to observe the story and how it's observed and being able to feel the kind of mind that is observing it, you know.
Yeah.
So, you know, Kubrick, obviously, how every frame in his movies just you can't understand. Like, what? Why, how is it you feel conscious? You know, the every frame feels conscious. You know, one of the first movies that kind of got me to thinking, you know, maybe I should get into movies.
Yeah.
I saw when I was 15 years old called Walkabout, you know, Nicholas Roeg, you know, that kind of thing. Wim Wenders' early movies like Kings of the Road and Alice in the Cities, just in the kind of voyeuristic nature.
Yeah.
But, you know, the idea was to create something of profound austerity that would really sensitize you to what's happening on the subtlest level and make a movie that just scrutinizes.
Yeah. It's just to sort of jump back to, you were talking about how hard it was to get the film made with the difficulty. What was difficult about convincing, say, UA or other studios to...
Well, you walk into a room and you tell them, you know, I want to make a film about a writer writing his book. Like, box office gold. And, I think the appeal of the film is very difficult to communicate.
Yeah.
I think Phil and I, and of course Danny Futterman too, the screenwriter, you know, we believed it. Kubrick says, I got that, somebody gave me that Kubrick book,
the archives.
It comes with a CD, which I would recommend to anybody. In that CD, in an interview, he says, you know, if you're right about something, people tend to know it, you know. And for a year, they didn't seem to like agree with us, and maybe we were wrong. But
now, Kubrick had to often wait many years after the film before people came around. But you're seeing, I mean, the response has been pretty amazing to this film.
Well, this is a digital era, so it's like everything's accelerated.
Right. Okay. In terms of the production design, did you have access to the original crime scene photos, and what did you use to get that period detail?
We had the crime scene photos, and we had a lot of stuff. The original, the Richard Brooks film, was shot in Holcomb and Garden City and used the real locations in the courtroom. That's the actual house in the Brooks film. That was helpful only a few years after, like 6 or 7 years after the murders, that thing was shot. Richard Avedon traveled to Kansas, as is portrayed in the film, at the invitation of Capote, and he photographed not just the killers there, but, you know, all around town, went to the Dewey home, you know, the cemetery, the courtroom. A few weeks before he passed away, he invited Phil over for dinner and cooked him, you know, linguine with clams, and for 3.5 hours shared everything he had, and he gave us all those contact sheets. So we've got, you know, hundreds of photographs that we based it on. It was a strong effort to be accurate, you know, to be obedient to what was. But the goal never was to convince anybody of anything. It should be right, but, you know, it's a period piece. And the pitfalls of that kind of thing is you give it too much importance, and it becomes some kind of a barrier between the story and what's really happening, and kind of separates you from it. So the movie doesn't hit you over the head with a period, or strain itself to sell 1961 or anything like that. And much more concerned just how it communicates tonally, the production design, than is that what Perry Smith's journal actually looked like.
Did you consider anybody else other than Philip Seymour Hoffman?
No, he was it. Danny Futterman told me, if you want to do this movie, like, I would love you to do this movie. And we talked about it for about 2 weeks before I agreed to do it. And then we talked about who would be Capote. And Phil was the only name that we ever came up with. And had he said no, I probably would have
Okay, well... two different questions. One about the cinematography, but then do you have anything in mind for Philip Seymour Hoffman so it doesn't get anchored?
I was very privileged to work with another good friend of mine, Adam Kimmel, who is a great DP, who was somebody who I work with doing commercials, as was the production designer and the costume designer. It's basically my commercial crew. The production designer, by the way, this is his first feature as a production designer. And... And as far as Phil goes, and what he might do in the future, he'll do whatever I tell him to do. So,
what did you do as a director in order to get that quietness, not just in acting, but in all the other elements of the filmmaking?
I think the key to making a movie that is finds power in silence and, you know, quiet moments and simplicity and a prose kind of approach too, you know, like the visual language is simple. The key to finding the power there is not approaching it from the outside in. Like, I want it to be like Kubrick, but it's more of what are you really going after in the moment? I think the screenplay gave the opportunity, you know, these scenes were just so rich with complexity that really the goal was, you know, the invention born of necessity was to direct and sensitize and magnify, you know, your attention to what was happening. Somebody said to me recently, why did you choose such a sedate style? And I don't think it's sedate at all. I think when a movie has a cut every like second and a half or 2 seconds, I that's to me is sedating. I get numb. I don't, you know, I'm not paying attention. To me, it's the movie needed it. You know, that there's so much happening beneath the surface, and very naturally, when you figure out how do you like take this thing and really give emphasis to it, at least my natural style and preferences are to get quiet and, you know, put the microscope lens up there.
Are you working on anything new now, or are you just...
I'm done. This is it. I'm done. So
that was your retrospective.
Yeah, my retrospective. No, I've begun working on developing something that's going to take some time, and I'm reading. I'm looking for stuff. So, if anybody's got a great idea,
what was your initial interest in?
Well, I wanted to make a documentary portrait of Bobby Fischer, who again was a character like Truman and like Speed Levitt from The Cruise, that whose life I think represents more than just himself. And he was 14 years old when he became the United States chess champion, and he did so in a time when chess was more than a game. It was the metaphor for the Cold War, and he became an important personality. And then a kind of pressure in a culture that, you know, that would breed his genius into something so malignant as a cold warrior, you know, as a child. By 16, he was living alone. Eventually, you know, the Russians stopped running and had to sit down and face him in Reykjavik, and he crushed Boris Spassky like a schoolboy. You know, they draped the American flag around him, and there was a celebration, and he was the most famous person in the world for a few minutes. You know, what happens when you cultivate your brain like that? What happens to a person like that? He just seemed to be this remnant of that horrible militant mentality. You know, the Secretary of State is calling him up, and, you know, you're important. And the truth is, what became of that is about the ugliest thing you could possibly imagine, with his insanely rabid anti-Semitism. Anyway, this went on too long, but it was a story of a Mozart-level genius not being governed by any kind of wisdom, but governed by the kind of things that govern this country.
Did your experience making documentary help you have a sense of objectivity?
Yeah, but I think that's my nature too, and maybe that's why I'm attracted to documentary, and that's why I'm attracted to the kind of movies that do the same thing. But yeah, people are complex, and the moment you label them or you make it so simple, this or that, I think it reduces it to something that negates the relevant truth of things. So.
And Capote obviously helped establish that idea. The idea of the nonfiction novel was new. I mean, now it's all...
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Capote looked at these guys in a very unconventional way, in a very nonconformist way. I mean, these guys killed a family. Yeah. But he did not look at them with a conventional attitude of hatred or fear, but fascination and curiosity. And a real interest in human nature.
Okay. Go ahead. Then, so this will be our last question.
The power of storytelling and its ability to, two things. One is what that's about. What those scenes are about is just the ability to witness in all of its forms Capote's ability to seduce. He was a seducer. And he could seduce anybody from like a 16-year-old girl in Kansas to like, you know, Alvin Dewey, who's the lead KBI investigator, to, you know, these guys, to, you know, the literati of, you know, the late 50s, early 60s when the movie's set. You know, what I would say about storytelling, seducing, I would say it's as much as who he was as whatever the hell it was that he was saying. My attitude about the film is that as much of a story as it is, it's also really just a portrait. When I was answering the question, how do you go about organizing all that information? And for me, you could begin subtracting when you realize like what you're after. And for me, it's really a portrait. And the purpose of the portrait is to somehow communicate the condition of a person's mind, you know, and the consequences of it. And in these storytelling moments, you see at once like the charm and magnetism of a person with charisma, and then the film shows you the sort of disturbing reality that's behind that charisma.
Well, if this is your last film, you're going out in style. So,
oh, thank you.
And if not, we'll have you back for
thank
more.
Thank you so much.
Thanks.
Appreciate
a lot.
It.
Thank you for listening. The Pinewood Dialogues at Museum of the Moving Image are made possible by generous support from the Pannonia Foundation. To learn more about the museum, visit www.movingimage.us.